expressed in her beautiful, intimate way. And it's really during the look I can say that Sir Philip was the one who told me about Lady Barbara. And since then, Mama has had used her as a channel for so many. And that was in 1944 when I first had that phone call from her and learned that Father had sent three of his women back to spread his love and word. Those three women were Dorina Machiavelli, Nadine Tolstoy, and Elizabeth Patterson. And so when we both, in that way, heard Father through those ladies. And I hope Phyllis gives you a lot of time for questions and answers, because there are so many fascinating questions that you could ask her with regard to the times that she was with Father since 1952, when she first met him here at the center. And then the years before, when we lived with the ladies for a short time, about 4 years, Phyllis and myself. And then, of course, she had many, many plans which have come to fruition, many of them. And it is a wonderful example of a real lover who is so one-pointed in Baba that these plans are not just in the realm of ideas. They actually do come to fruition when one is willing to remain faithful to them. And one of them I used to hear Phyllis talk about was that there should be a journal devoted to Baba. And then that was 22 years ago. And this is Phyllis's baby, The Awakening Magazine. And this last issue, devoted to music and art, is one that we all value extremely. Of course, the original issues, they were made unique because Baba sent Phyllis many, many original messages that appeared in The Awakening for the first time. And as a matter of fact, that's one of the things I trust she'll tell us about this evening, that she has had a nice anthology of Baba's very special discourses collected, and they will be printed, and she'll tell us all the other little babies that have come to fruition.
Yeah. Well, first of all, it's a real treat that I'm here with you. It goes without saying. This Bob was great because I didn't know the last minute that I was going to make it. But everything gets timed, you know. Baba's time. That's what they call Baba's time. Baba's time on Earth. And I've wanted to visit the center for a long time. And now I'm here just when real favorite people are here and new ones to meet. It's really nice. I didn't know what to talk about this evening because Kitty has asked me to speak at the center Friday and tell my experiences of how I met Bob and stuff. So I don't know whether to say go through that here and then again Friday, or maybe tonight just flow along and questions and sort of a little, you know, discussion and a little, you know, just get into a real rap session about Baba. So I'll just wait to feel what you people would like, because I'll probably see some of you Friday. Would you all like to hear how I came to Baba, or have you any special subject you'd like me to tell about or talk about? Or what would you think? I sort of like to feel what people want rather than what I
think. How you came to Bob, because then there are always a little facets of it that you know, supplement on Friday.
Tell us how you told Adele about Bob.
Well, that goes back to how I heard about Bob. I did write this up in the awake and get a plug in. And,
hi.
Oh, hi. Mary Ada.
Carrie Ann's pretty good.
Well, first of all, I was going through John Matthews' papers that are at the center, and I found these two. I just grabbed these two as sort of a keynote. This is Avatar Meher Baba's message on the occasion of his 72nd birthday. That was the 25th of February, 1966. Be composed in the reality of my love. For all confusion and despair is your own shadow, which will vanish when I speak the word. That's really good for me to hear again. That all confusion and despair is my own shadow. And then this one was typical of the things that Baba would send. This was sent August 25th, 1958. Inform each concerned in the United States my instructions as follows. Stop. Circumstances during these 3 months will put to the test the love and faith of my lovers. So try your best to keep firm hold on my Dhamma. Stop. Do not talk ill of others and try not to think ill of others. Stop. Remember no correspondence with me or Eric. Signed, Baba from seclusion. You know, all these messages that, you know, came at a certain time and put us into a certain channel, you know, when you go back, you see that they're really forever. They just apply every day. Well, just to go back a little bit, how I first heard of Baba, like everybody, I guess, you start out by trying to find out what everything meant, why, what life is all about, and you study this and you study that. And I started out on the real intellectual level with philosophy. That was my pet subject. And that didn't seem to really answer, I guess you'd say, my heart. It might have fed my mind a little bit. I was really into that. And then I left college and studied more philosophy at NYU in Columbia, studying the philosophy of Whitehead, if anybody is interested. I think he's one of the great philosophers of our time. But that's still, there's not the heart in it, not the real meaning. And also I was beginning to have a very odd experience. Which these philosophies don't really explain, like inner visions and psychic experiences and all sorts of weirdo things. And at that time, which is not like today, when there are all so many books out and so many groups and societies and gurus floating around, and you really, it's all laid out there for you to find your way in. In those days, I went down to Schulte's bookstore in New York, this giant secondhand bookstore, and would paw through all these dusty volumes, you know, and find something on this and on that, and just burrow your way through it like a reading worm, bookworm, to find the answers, and still not find the answers. And I remember one book, this was in philosophy class, we had a book supposed to be, I've even forgotten who it was, it was called The Meaning of Consciousness, or some title like that. And it got more and more meaningless. It got more and more meaningless. It's like at the end of the book, you're absolutely less than you did in the beginning. I was so ridiculous. I threw the book across the room. And I had a tremendous library at home with all sorts of stuff. And threw the book. I left it there on the floor, you know, disgusted for the whole thing. It was so funny, you know. Days later, I pick up this book and I try to put it back into the shelf. And I put it back, and there was an old, torn up secondhand volume called anyway, it was The Life of Ramakrishna by Romain Rolland. Well, I read that book, and it was sort of like the first crack in the dam. The Life of Ramakrishna and the love, because as you know, he was a perfect master of his time. And the love of God that poured out of that book, so that was like the first touch of reality, of spiritual reality, out of all this maze of stuff. And it just touched my heart, and I had one of my first real spiritual experiences after reading that book. And it was like I woke up one morning, or sat up, you know, the dawn was just coming up over the garden, and it was so beautiful. And I realized I can only describe it as my essence of myself, not my personality, of course, not the body or the mind or anything, but the essence of my beingness. And I knew that I was immortal in that spiritual sense. I felt the essence of personality, which is not, you know, the godhood in that sense, but just the essence that has survived, you know, millions of years and will survive many more years. It was a tremendous experience. So the book was already kind of fermenting. And so when we moved to New York, I started studying Vedanta at the Ramakrishna Center. There again, you know, the monks there, maybe you know some of them. They have a very intellectual approach. They teach you. They teach you like teachers can teach the Vedanta. And it was very dry, but at least there was always Ramakrishna in the background with his love. And somehow, you know, and especially two things that Ramakrishna said. He said, seek the feet of the living master. He said that over and over again. And then he said again that nothing matters but love for God. You know, that God will come. If you cry, there's a beautiful paragraph, he says, if you cry like a child for his mother, then God has to come to you. You know, and things like that, and it was spoken from his own experience, so it just affects you. That's the interesting thing about words, you know. You could, like I say, going into Shelby's bookstore or the theological library at Columbia, you know, bookshelves. All those words, some of them very beautiful, but they're not spoken from the state of consciousness of experience. And they don't touch you. You know, where are all those sermons, you know, those dead dry books of 50 years? They don't touch you like the words of someone who's experienced. You know, like you read the words of St. Francis, the poem that he made, you know, just a few poems, the prayer to the sun. And it just touches you because it came from the heart, from experience. So, things like that were, meanwhile, was, you know, going on in my personal life and stuff. And getting more and more hungry for the real experience. And I could see the monks were dear people and all, but they weren't, they didn't have what Ramakrishna had, actually. And nobody else that I could find. And although I met some very wonderful people in New York, all sorts of interesting people. And then one day, this I've told many times, but one time, one Sunday, I went to the Ramakrishna Center. They had this giant picture of Ramakrishna, and it just blanked out. This beautiful white light came out of it. And I heard a voice say, a man's voice say, he is your Jesus. And of course, I'd always been like many of us brought up in the Christian background, a devotion to Jesus. I never liked church, you know, at all, but I always had a feeling for Jesus. And I looked, turned around from there to there, and coming out on the platform was this figure of a man, very dynamic figure, but slight in build. It was massive, auburn hair, and this light mustache, and flashing dark eyes and face. And then I heard these words he was speaking, playing parts in a language that I knew was a foreign language. I knew right away it was Aramaic, or how do you know these things? And I heard the two languages together. I heard the sound of the Aramaic and the translation of English, and it was the Sermon on the Mount, the first line, you know, and so on. And I just got so absorbed that I just lost all sense of where I was or anything. And there was that bliss and that love too. And I just thought that was it. And I suddenly came out of it and people were leaving. Nicola Nana was walking off the stage in his yellow robe. You know, I started to stumble out of it. And I had other experiences like that of Jesus, seeing him very vividly. And people with him, faces very vividly. Have his disciples and stuff. And I thought, well, this is strange, you know. Where am I getting all these things from? And then shortly after that, that was in the spring of 42. In May 42, I got this little card, this engraved invitation or something, to hear Princess Manchadelli speak. I think the title was Love is a Remedy. Maybe that was one of my favorite titles of hers anyway. It might not have been that one, but at the Hotel Martinique, old hotel in there. So I thought, well, I've been to every lecture in New York, I'll go to this one too, you know. So I went. And the strange thing of all these weird visions I had before this time, one was of a woman, the face of a woman, very beautiful thing, sort of like something by Michelangelo. I don't know, you had a particular picture of the face. The Saint Anne. But she had this turban on and a jewel here on the turban. It was a beautiful amethyst, so I didn't know, you know, a little bit of awful. An amethyst and a jewel. It's a color of devotion. Object. Spiritual devotion. And her eyes came very piercingly at me. Well, when I walked into this lecture and Lorena came out, she had this turban on. She always wore a turban. Was this person, seen, subtle or whatever. And this brings to mind also that Baba, years before he came to the West, he told his disciples that he was going to the West and he would find such and such and such a one who were in his circle, and you all know Baba's circle, and he would describe some of them, and he said, one will be a woman who wears a turban. And this was sort of Narina's trademark or fashion or whatever. She always wore a turban. And she spoke very beautifully about Baba. And I was actually, so many times with Narina, I wasn't really paying attention to the word. It was the vibration, the light, you know, that came out of her. She was really kind of transformed in a way that's kind of difficult to describe, and people debate it now and rackets about it. But it was like, at times, really, this wasn't true at this particular moment, but at times, the face of Narina was just transformed into Baba's face. I don't know, maybe some of you have ever seen it, but anyway. So, I was sort of impressed, but there was no Baba picture there. So, I think that, but I went to visit them. They were living in East 67th Street. This is the old said Baba had sent Narina Machiavelli and then Nadine Tolstoy, who was the daughter-in-law of Count Leo Tolstoy, the one from the famous author, and Elizabeth Patterson. And so they invited me for tea or whatever. And I walked in, I think it was Nadine's room, I'm not sure. Her wall was covered with Baba pictures. And I remember as I walked in the door, there was one little picture here of Baba. I can point it out in the Baba book, but where Baba's hair was flowing down, and had his white saffron on, and his profile, and it's exactly like this face that I've been seeing of Jesus, you know. Wow. Yeah. Actually, that time they called Baba Sri Narayana. They called him the perfect master or something. They really weren't using the word Avatar. The common title of Baba. Anyway, that's how I first heard of Baba and got right involved with it. And I felt Baba's presence and his love so much through the women. I didn't even read, I have to say this, it's a confession, but I didn't even read the disco. You know, I'm just taken in by Baba's love. It's like I had read so much and, you know, all that intellectual stuff, and I wasn't really in the mood for more of it at that point. And also, when you study Vedanta, there's so many of these points that are, you know, you already know all about reincarnation, it's common knowledge and the planes and stuff, you know. Go into that Buddhism. So it is. Baba has clarified some of the points and brought it all in a language of today that anybody can get into rather than going through these, you know, Buddhist texts. Anyway, at that time, Noreen and Elizabeth and Nadine in 42, that was during the war. And of course, I was all ready to just take off. But it wasn't anywhere near a possibility. They wouldn't let you travel during the war. And we were all hoping that Baba would... That it was a tremendous... It's hard to realize now, but there was a tremendous expectancy, especially the things that Baba would say and in letters and stuff. He's going to break us out. And it was... You know, I just forgot all... Everything else there in a sense of... What does it matter, careers and life, you know, story of your own? The silence, Baba's just going to transform the world. So we all were kind of living, you know, on this edge of trying to realize it. And of course, when you first came to Baba, that seemed so outstanding, the things that Baba said about sound. It was like the world was going to end tomorrow, you know, and everything would be true. And Rena just kept, you know, it was very much in the atmosphere that. So we were just waiting, you know. Meanwhile, then came this part about the center. And I got involved with them in that. Well, those people all heard the story of Elizabeth's gift to the center, and the father's property and stuff. And we started going, coming down here when it was real wild and everything. There was no light, no electricity, no this and that. It was really like camping out in the wildwood. The paths weren't even clear, just one little path from the lantern cabin, the one on the hill to the kitchen, you know. And the snakes hanging on the roof. We wore boots up to here. And we all had snake bite kits, you know, in the cabin. Oh, there's stuff you don't worry about now. I was thinking that the other day, everybody running around like crazy. Wouldn't dare. We had these big kerosene lanterns to carry around.
Boots,
real jungle boots from wherever they were fighting. We got the secondhand army.
Car.
Yeah, that was
really
fun.
I have some of those kind of boots.
You do? Yeah, right. Then we learned about, you know, the six, what are the six poison snakes in South Carolina? Oh, I and anyway, I'll tell you a little story about snakes. I'm digressing maybe, but my mother heard that I was going to South Carolina. She heard about all these things. She's horrified. And she went to this friend of ours who was, in his own way, an advanced person. And
pick it up there.
And so my mother worried about it, and he said, "Don't worry, Christine. I'll fix this." And Phyllis never seen the snake. And you know, I never knew the snake. I have never seen the snake on the center all years and all that. And that comes up to the fake snake bite story of mine when Baba was actually. Well, I'll skip in time. We would live through the 40s and we lived through the early 50s waiting for Baba. Then Cape, the most important thing, I think, though, in between there was the new life phase of Baba, because here we are waiting desperately to meet Baba, not allowed to travel, And then Elizabeth and Irina, Baba called them back to India in 1947. And so Irina said to me, Phyllis, what shall I tell Baba? Of course, I've had letters back and forth. I got a beautiful one, my first letter from Baba. It was written by Margaret Crabb. And I have that. And Baba said he's very happy that it come to him and so on. But then Irina said, what shall I tell Baba? You know. Oh, on account. India, and India. So she did. And she very faithfully wrote to us almost every week to Adele and myself a letter. And one letter she said, I told Baba. And for 2 weeks, she said, Baba went around the ashram and he asked everyone about me that had met. I had met Dr. Duncan, he visited us, and Mary G. and Elizabeth, asking about me, and saying 1 minute, I'll send for her, and the next minute, no, it's not the right thing. You know, for 2 weeks, you find And I was so happy thinking that Bob was thinking about me. I didn't care what he was thinking, but he was thinking about me, you know. And she said that Bob decided, no, that I would come to India later. And later, actually, turned out to be 1962. Mm-hmm. So, it's Baba's time again. So then to me, and I think to all of us at that time, the new life was perhaps the most dramatic thing we lived through with Baba. And it's really hasn't completely been written out, the whole story of it. Although I understand Don Stevens now, when he was over in India, got a great deal of material about it from Mani and all of them. And he's written a book on the new life, which is coming out. And that's neat. Anyway, it was a great shock to everybody, especially over there. They had lived their lives with Baba. They'd given up their families. And so many people were dependent on Baba. And all those people went through the step-by-step thing of the new life where Baba was abandoning, first of all, his role as Satguru, as master, and saying he would be down on the level with all everyone as their companion in the new life. And he disbanded the ashram and all these people. There were different arrangements. While they had different things. Some went back completely into the world, and others were taken care of, and so on and so on. And a handful went with him. And it was very dramatic. And I remember that I had a very interesting, I won't go in as a digression, but on the 1st of January, 1948, I had this fantastic vision that I went back and lived through a whole life on Atlantis with this whole destruction in the world there and everything, long story. But anyway, I knew that was a big junction point somehow, that moment, that first day. And then just 5 days later, whenever the letter came from me, it was the first letter that came from Baba that the whole new life would begin. And he listed all these things that would happen. And from then on, we kept constantly getting new things about. But the basic things were said in that first letter, that he would enter, this is the end of the false beginning and the beginning of the true end. Mm-hmm. See, that's like the beginning of end of an old cycle. And that he would be entering the new life, and that he abandoned, it's hard to just, I shouldn't paraphrase it, but basically, he was entering the new life, all of us would enter the new life, and most important of all, a great personal disaster would be facing him, stuff like that. So we all lived the following 2 years, especially, through the new life with Baba. And there were times when Baba would have us do things to share the new life. And even other things that the Mandalay were doing, we tried to share. I remember there was a whole list, Darwin, you remember that list of things that they were all trying to do? Like, be absolutely honest, and to do this and do that, and not to, the most, I think the hardest thing through all kinds of conditions. The hardest thing still is to always be cheerful, no matter how you feel. And of course, when they were with Baba in the new life, they had to really do this. No matter how they felt, they had to outwardly be cheerful and not complain. Of course, not backward, that goes without saying, but they had to just maintain, you know. And there's some very dramatic things in the new life about that, that you have read, maybe. Like the one man who's, I forget, Dr. somebody, maybe it's Dr. Fisher, his daughter was getting married, and he was not allowed to get mail, but somehow by some chance he got this letter and read it, where the daughter says, "If you don't come to my wedding, you're not my father anymore," or something like that. And he just broke down. He couldn't help it. And Baba found him crying, and he said, "Remember what you promised." And he couldn't control his tears, and Baba sent him away. The new life was not a joke.
You know the rest of that story?
Huh?
You know the rest of that story?
No, I don't.
It's really a very beautiful story.
Oh, I know. They acted it out in the Sufi class. I'm not good on all these details, but I remember how that was very dramatic. And other stories like that in the new life. Yes, what was he doing?
Well, he got back home. The Baba told him to continue the new life and to beg. So his family ostracized him. Oh. The whole community ostracized him. Mm-hmm. And he was wandering by himself out on some road, and I believe Baba, you know, was nearby. He said, "Who is that fellow?" I sent somebody to him, before him. And he recognized Baba and he wept to him. And Baba said, "I release you from the discipline that you've been doing." So he went back to his family, and everything was on. But he spent, I don't know how long, doing it.
Yeah, he went, I think the mentally went probably through the hardest things in their life. I mean, they've had hard things, but that was, especially to not treat Baba as master in that sense. He said, "I won't have my nazir on you anymore." Now this for us over here in America, you know, okay, that's not the same thing in the sense that they had every moment of their day ordered by Baba, and with his nazir completely, you know, no matter what happened, they were right there, Baba, you know, with his nazir. And then to feel that they were completely on their own, even in their relationship to God now. And Baba had, in the new life, the prayers to God, he himself prayed to God, like very much like Jesus, you know, who was God, but he says the prayer. And for them, it was really a big change in their feeling about Baba. They weren't allowed to touch his feet or bow down to him and so on. So the new life was very dramatic. And Baba said, even though we met him, he said, "We're still in the new life." And he said, "The new life will continue even if there's no one left to live it." And we are now still in that new life. Mm-hmm. Forget that sometimes when you go back and you read the conditions. And that beautiful song of the new life, "Helpless and hopeless now we are. And without hope we abandon hope, we abandon the," you know, what a beautiful new life. If you think things are rough, well, you're in the new life, that's all. Anyway, Baba finally did come in 52. And I was asking Elizabeth last night, because Baba had planned to come in 51. And I had all these years heard the story that he didn't come because his house was not ready. Baba had said he wanted the house built just on the center. And I always thought that was because the house was ready. Well, Elizabeth said it wasn't only that, it was the difficulty of Baba wanted to come. He said he'd come for a whole year. And with the 12 disciples, six men, six women, and to arrange for for 12 or 13 foreign people to come and stay here, you know, the visas and the whole thing, all of that. They had to guarantee certain amounts of money for each one. And she said that all took such a fantastic amount of muddling around with the State Department. That's what delayed. But of course it wasn't delayed. Well, why did you come if you do? And of course, meanwhile, we had built up quite a following or gathering of Baba people, or people who were interested in Baba, through Narina's work and Lucy's work in New York. We had this giant mailing list, and we were trying desperately for the, the last year to keep up with everybody, you know, because when Baba comes, he comes like, what is that, the thief in the night, you know. And you have to have somebody's name and phone. You know, and people being people are horrible, like keeping up to date. And we were so afraid that somebody, we couldn't find them when Baba came. And then also in your personal life, I look back on it now, I was tossed from job to job. I got fired so often. You know, I lost one job. But every job I went, I'd make friends with somebody and then hear about Baba, you know. And then I'd lose that job and float around and go somewhere else. We were bouncing around. But it's like we found Baba lovers that way. It's like Baba, like this piece of chewing gum he was sticking with here. And then came the final moment when Baba came. And of course, Adele and I knew that we weren't supposed to know, but we knew the time that the plane would arrive. Baba said he didn't want anybody to meet him except Elizabeth and the old time disciples, Margaret and Delia from London. And then he was going to run things. Of course, in those days, there was only one way to get to Myrtle Beach. That was the train, unless you drove, which was a long 2-day thing. The night train to Myrtle Beach. I forget what it's called. Palmetto Special or something. Out of Penn Station. And this was April 20th, 1952. And the train was leaving at midnight, as usual, from the tracks, blah, blah, down. So I got a tremendous thing. Well, we know Baba's going to be right there. He has to be right there. So, Adele and I were down to Penn Station. We thought we'd peek at Baba. And the Baba, he had his alphabet boy. He immediately had taken out his board and he was saying, and he was talking to Dr. Duncan, right? He was saying, careful. And then the funniest thing, I'll never forget this. I found out later what happened, but here we were hiding behind this pillar, you know. And suddenly, like 2 feet, I really mean 2 feet in front of us, Margaret Kraft walked by. She didn't see it. Face like this, you know, she was like a somnambulist going by. I heard later that they had sent her up to get some aspirin or something, and that drugstore was up on her. So I said to Dale, I don't think we should be here. So we went home. And that was my first feeling. Of course, Baba was doing it all. I felt that I disobeyed Baba and I was going through all these heavy things. So finally comes a letter from Myrtle Beach. Baba had originally, the letter said, would you like to come and spend 3 weeks with me? Baba invited me. So we wrote back, wonderful, yes. And then comes in, the next week comes another letter. Baba's changed his plan, would you like to spend 2 weeks with me? Yeah, I mean, anything, you know, yes, Baba is great, you know. And then finally comes the third letter. Baba says, would you like to spend a week with me? So we said yes, and then how it was finally arranged. And we drove down with the Winterfells and Agnes Bourne, an old Baba lover who had met Baba years ago in the 30s, and I think her visit with Baba then was so beautiful. Been written up somewhere. And while we were driving down, she was reminiscing about me when I first got with her. And as we got closer and closer to the center, it was like coming closer and closer to the center of the universe. It was strange. It was like an awful thing happening, which was true. Well, I could imagine now, say, you're on a spaceship, you know, and you've been traveling, you know, 18 million light years or something, and you're finally coming in, you know, the feeling of a million-year journey, you know, finally. And as we drove past the gate of the center, of course, I've been to the center so many times, but just as we drove past, Fred slowed down the car, you know, and it was like a breeze of love coming out. It was almost like you could see it coming out. And then we got to the old Lafayette Hotel, and we had an appointment to see Bobby the next morning. And the phone rang, and it was Elizabeth. And she was confirming that we were to come at 9 o'clock the next morning. And she said, "Yeah, Baba is waiting for you." And I just almost dropped the phone. Suddenly, just absolutely incredible. He's waiting for me. Really? I don't know. You just have to have it said to you, "Baba's waiting for you." Yes. And then. So I didn't really sleep the whole night after. I guess I did a little bit, and I dreamt. I had made a dress to see Baba in, because I had written to Kitty and found out what color Baba liked. He liked blue. So I had bought some material and made a blue dress. And I was still sewing it, you know, all the way down. And then in the dream, the dress was full of pins. And it was tan that Baba and pulled out all the dirt involved. And the next morning, I got up. It was a beautiful morning. It was May 10th, 1952, and drove to the center. Like John Bass was in the car with us. And he stopped all the first. And then came my appointment. And I must say, it's strange when I go around the center. Everything looks so much smaller and darker. I know it's older, but see, Baba was there. Everything seemed to me, you know, it seemed fantastic. The lagoon cabin seemed to me. Delia was introducing everybody to Baba that night. And she said, "Sri Mirabal, this is Felicity." And I caught my first glimpse. I couldn't have imagined.